Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another edition of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Every weekday except Thursday, that is, and of course, as you will have figured out right away, today is Thursday. And today, for your enjoyment, I have a story that was written in, well, probably in 1886. It was published in the January 1887 issue of the West Shore Magazine, which was a little literary magazine published out of Portland, Oregon for about 20 years, starting in about 1775. This article appears to be fiction. For those of you gold mining aficionados, this is a lost cabin gold mine story. It's called The Hermit of the Siskiyous. The citizens of the fictional town of Betsyville proved less than hospitable to the mysterious stranger, and after he left, they never did find the source of all the gold he found. As short stories go, it's a little on the long side, but I'm going to read it to you now. Here stood, a quarter of a century ago, in the heart of the Siskiyou Mountains, a rude cabin of poles and brush, thatched with closely packed branches of young firs. The exact location matters little, for the iron finger of time has effaced all traces of its existence and demonstrated the mutability of all things terrestrial, even in those mountain solitudes. Many years ago, the poles and brush were swept by a landslide into the noisy, dashing stream flowing through the gulch at the base of the hill, far up on whose side stood the cabin, while a giant fir whose grasp upon the earth was thus loosened till it succumbed to the power of the west wind and toppled to the earth, now lies prostrate and broken across the site of this once humble habitation. Even the rude trail that wound tortuously through the dense forest and along the bank of the rapid stream is now so completely obliterated by the rains and snows, so blocked of fallen trees and masses of earth and rock brought down by the mountain's steep sides and the melting snows and copious rains of each vernal season, that he would indeed be well skilled in woodcraft who would successfully trace it from the old mining camp whence it started, some 4 miles downstream, to the site of the vanished hut. Time was when this desolate spot was the center of an absorbing interest for scores of human beings, but so now few know that it ever even existed, and fewer its exact location. While the incident I am about to relate has already been relegated to the domain of fiction or legendary romance, save by the few survivors of those whom the shifting kaleidoscope of life brought together for a brief period in contact with the peculiar and mysterious being who built and occupied this rude habitation. The Siskiyou Mountains lie on the borderline of California and Oregon, stretching westward from the Cascades to the Coast Range. They form the dividing ridge between two great rivers, both of which have cleft deep passages through the obstructing Coast Range and pour their annual floods in deep, rapid, and turgid streams between the lofty walls of rugged rock which confine them to their narrow channels. The Klamath in California and the Rogue in Oregon are alike in all their essential features, turbulent, impetuous, unnavigable. From the dividing ridge of the Siskiyous, each receives a multitude of effluents, both small and great, which pour down in noisy haste from their birthplace in the springs and melting snows of the mountain summits. On many of these streams, gold was discovered early in the 50s, and for a number of years, every bend and flat was the scene of mining operations of the primitive rocker or long sluice character. In some of these localities where the extent of mining ground was comparatively large, or which were so located to be a convenient central point for several outlying districts, quite extreme camps sprang up and flourished for several years. Some of these have still a sort of post-mortem existence, though the great majority of them have lost all material being and are rapidly falling into the obscurity of things forgotten. During the mining period referring to, such a camp as I have described stood upon one of the larger tributaries of the Klamath, flowing down the southern slope of the mountains. It occupied an abbreviated flat at a bend in the stream, first known as Sailor's Bend because color was originally found there by two adventurous seamen who had deserted their vessels to experience the hazards, privations, excitements, and golden possibilities that made up the sum of the pioneer miner's existence. Later, when a half dozen brush and shake shanties centered around a larger and more pretentious structure of logs, shakes, and canvas, which did duty as a store, saloon, post office, gambling hall, and general social rendezvous for the miners along the stream for several miles above and below, it was christened Betsyville by some facetious miner, in a moment of witty inspiration, and wore the title proudly until its last occupant deserted it and left its dilapidated structures a prey to the elements. Although a night never passed without the exhibition of considerable animation at Betsyville, Saturday night was the one bright particular star of its septuary round. It was then that the whole population of the neighborhood gathered at the rendezvous and partook of such good cheer as Big Johnson was accustomed to dispense. It was an occasion of much good-natured hilarity, merging upon occasion into boisterousness on the part of some of the convivials whose supply of brains was not sufficiently weighty to keep down the cane-raising tendency of Big Johnson's liquor. All such were endured as long as there remained a shred of virtue upon which to hang endurance, and then were summarily quieted by Johnson to the thankful relief of his less noisy patrons. Cards, jokes, stories, yarns, cigars, pipes, together with frequent indulgences in whiskey straight, supplanted at times by the rasping tones of a tortured fiddle squeaking out its enlivening accompaniment to a real hornpipe or a genuine stag dance, made up the sum of the night's entertainment, which very seldom ended before the brightening of the eastern sky heralded the approach of the Sabbath sun. Sunday was a day of rest, if not devotion. Avaricious indeed was the man who worked his claim on the Sabbath. This much of the influence of the habits of other days still clung to them. They observed the fourth commandment so far as to remember the Sabbath day, but almost to a man they neglected the injunction to keep it holy. Sunday was a good day for doing all sorts of odd jobs, for washing clothes, splitting wood, buying provisions at the store, mending tools and clothing, and in the afternoon and evening, resuming at Johnson's the thread of enjoyment where it was broken off the night before. Sunday night was very similar to its predecessor, although the zest and freshness that had marked the revelries terminating the week's labor had passed away. It was in the midst of such a scene as this, late one Saturday night, that a stranger entered the door, which stood hospitably open, though, if the truth be told, Johnson, in opening it, did so less from the promptings of a spirit of hospitality than from a desire to exchange some of the foul, whiskey-laden atmosphere of the interior for the clear and uncontaminated air of the mountains. The newcomer stood for some minutes quietly watching the hilarious company, attracting but a casual glance from the revelers, for strangers were too common in Betsyville to be objects of curiosity. The mines at that season were thronged with men, constantly coming and going, and scarcely a night passed that half a dozen of them did not sample Johnson's firewater before seeking a couch beneath the spreading branches of some not too distant fir, or in rainy weather rolling in their blankets to court the balmy upon the floor of the saloon, despite the hilarity of the more wakeful guests. No attention was, therefore, paid to the newcomer until he stepped up to the rude bar, made of a slab sawed from the side of a log and turned with the bark side facing downward, and offered Johnson $1 for the loan of a blanket until morning. A man without a blanket in the mountains was as rare a sight as one without a horse on the plains, and in a short time every pair of eyes in the room was carefully scrutinizing the stranger. He was a tall man, of refined features and expression, polite in his manner and dignified in his bearing, and yet the fact that he was traveling without a regular outfit created such a suspicion in the minds of the proprietor and his patrons that the object of it could not but see it reflected on their countenances. Johnson gruffly said that he had no blankets to lend, but would sell him one for $10. The stranger at once turned upon his heel and passed out the open door as silently and unexpectedly as he had entered. A few days after this incident at Betsyville, a miner whose claim was located further up the stream noticed while following down its banks on his way to the camp, smoke rising through the treetops on the side of a little gulch leading upward from a flat along the stream. Curiosity led him to follow up the bank of the little brook, which poured in alternate foam and crystals down the steep and rocky bed, and see who was camped in that beautiful but lonely spot. Ascending to a few hundred yards, he observed a rude cabin of brush and poles, standing a little back from the brook. From a clay chimney protruding from one corner of the structure, issued the column of smoke which had first attracted his attention. He climbed the bank and entered the cabin, expecting to find the owner within, as he had observed no signs of his presence on the outside. The hut was empty, not only of the owner, but of everything that could be classified as furniture or domestic equipment, save only for a few freshly cut boughs on one end, which were evidently being used as a bed, and a clay fireplace at the other end, which was blazing a fire of dried branches, whose ragged ends gave evidence of having been broken by hand. There was neither axe, spade, pick, nor, in fact, any article whatever usually seen about the cabin of a miner, and no camping utensils of any kind. The hut was evidently but 2 or 3 days old, and was just such a structure as a man of intelligence and ordinary ingenuity could erect with the aid only of a large pocket knife. The thick branches which formed the corner posts and cross pieces, along which the lighter ones were entwined to make the sides and top, had been sharpened with a knife and driven into the ground with a large stone, as the whittlings, discarded branches, and discolored stones scattered about on the hillside plainly witnessed. There were signs of a meal having been cooked, but no preparations for another were visible save only for the blazing fire and a few sharpened sticks with charred ends which had evidently been used for broiling spits. The intruder waited some time for the return of the unknown occupant, and then, his desire to reach camp conquering his curiosity, he left the place and resumed his journey downstream to Betsyville. In the course of his stay in camp, he made inquiries about the owner of the hut, only to learn that its existence was unknown to the frequenters of Johnson's. Only he and the mysterious builder had probably ever set sight on that rude brush habitation. His curiosity was now doubled, and on his return the next day he again paid the hut a visit, accompanied by one of the regular residents of Betsyville, who was also desirous of learning the identity of the new settler. He was again disappointed, for the cabin was still deserted, although there were a few observable traces of the presence of some person in the hut since the day before, not the least of which was the fact that the fire was still burning so freely as to indicate it had been replenished within the last half hour. When this intelligence was carried back to camp, it created considerable discussion among the frequenters of Johnson's establishment. There was nothing remarkable in the fact of some stranger having built a hut, for prospectors were continuously locating and housing themselves in temporary shanties of brush. What made this case the subject of curiosity and even suspicion were the two facts that the hut had evidently not been constructed by a person possessing a miner's or camper's outfit, and that the owner had apparently gone into hiding to avoid meeting his visitors. When Saturday night came, and with it the usual influx of miners from the more distant claims, the subject of the mysterious person who had built a brush hut with his jackknife received more serious attention and a free discussion. Sluices had been robbed in times past, and it was the general sense of the crowd that a man who would build a hut must be either a genuine miner or a man who expected to gain a living in some illegitimate way. The result of all this was that the following day, Sunday, an informal committee of half a dozen miners paid the newcomer a visit. As before, the occupant of the strange cabin was not at home, and the unbidden guests were compelled to act as their own entertainers. They could find nothing but the bare walls of the hut, the remains of a fire evidently several hours extinct, and a few crude utensils, such as could be fashioned with a pocket knife from the branches of neighboring trees. Nothing whatever could be found to indicate the method by which the mysterious builder of the shanty gained a livelihood, except that the slender skeletons of a few mountain trout and the cleanly picked bones of birds bore evidence that to the fact that game constituted a portion, at least, of his daily food. There was but meager satisfaction to be gained from contemplation of these remains, and the general feeling of irritation at having their curiosity baffled deepened their already unfavorable opinions of the stranger. "This here is unreasonable," said Bud Jackson, a tall Missourian who preferred rabbit hunting to grammar in his youthful days. "No man hain't got no right to live this away. I'm the last man in the world to interfere with a man's natural rights, but this here is a-goin' too fur, and I move we make him stop it." "What are you going to do about it?" queried Joe Coombs, a delegate from Indiana whose incessant praises of the muddy Wabash had won for him the title of Wabash Joe, which name was the only one known to belong to him by anyone in the camp except himself and Johnson in his official capacity as postmaster.
"What did I do? Why, I'd pull down his damned shanty and stick up a notice to clar out in them here diggings."
"Don't you think that would be a rather summary proceeding?" quietly asked a young doctor from New York, who had spent 2 years in the mines in an unsuccessful effort to acquire riches from the ground, in doing which he continually spent the various sums paid him upon the rather infrequent occasions when his professional services were required.
"A witch?"
"I mean that it is my opinion that we had better find a little more about this matter before we take such a decided action as you propose," said the doctor, who had come with the volunteer committee rather for purposes of exerting a restraining influence than with any motives of curiosity.
"That's all right, Doc, but how are you going to find out? This makes 3 times now, and he ain't never to home."
"Oh, yes, he is. The fire shows that."
"Well, he ain't never here when anybody else is."
"Well, that is because we did not come at the right time."
"Well, what did you do?"
"Why, I propose that we pin a notice on the side of the cabin telling him to come down to Johnson's and see us.
Correct!
Exclaimed Wabash Joe.
That's the ticket. You write her, Doc.
Taking a letter from his pocket and taking it from the envelope, he turned the letter over and wrote on the back as follows. You are respectfully requested to come down to Johnson's immediately and make a few explanations to the citizens of Betsyville. This invitation is very urgent, and a compliance with it is recommended by the committee.
That's the cheese! Stick her up and let's get!
Exclaimed Bud with enthusiasm. The notice was accordingly affixed to a twig and then fastened at the cabin entrance where it could not fail to be seen, and the committee departed in rather better spirits than they had felt a short time before. The informal report they made to the citizens of Betsyville and vicinity was satisfactory, inasmuch as it seemed to assure them that the mystery would soon be cleared up, and the miners turned their thoughts from the brush hut and its builder to a fuller consideration of the customary convivialities. Time passed, but the invited guest did not visit Johnson's. Thus, for 2 weeks the matter stood, and then, after a somewhat heated discussion, another Sunday visit was paid to the brush hut, this time by a regularly appointed committee, who were expected by their indignant constituents to do something. As on former occasions, the shanty was found without an occupant. The notice had been removed, and there were other evidences of the recent presence of somebody, chief of which was a freshly kindled fire burning in the rude fireplace.
I reckon he saw us coming and cleared out, said one of the committee.
That's it, said another, and I move we give him just 10 minutes to come back or down comes his shebang.
This proposition received varied and characteristic expressions of approval, and during the period of suspension of execution, the more curious of the visitors critically examined the surroundings of the cabin. A trail, not yet made very distinct by use, was found leading up the gulch, and this was followed with considerable eagerness until about 300 yards from the hut it became too indistinct to be easily traced. Careful inspection showed that the reason for this was that the person who used the trail branched off in a score of directions, evidently with the purpose of preventing the making of a beaten track, by which he might be followed to his destination. At least, that was the conclusion which the investigating committee arrived at, and it served to fix them in their previous conviction that the cabin was a nuisance which ought to be abated. More than 3 times the stated 10 minutes now having elapsed, and the mysterious stranger not having put in an appearance, the sentence was quickly executed. It took but a few minutes to demolish the hut and pile its constituent parts in a heap, with half a dozen large boulders placed on the top. But the work of writing a second notice to quit was one requiring more time and effort, since the doctor was not present to take charge of that Herculean task. Wabash Joe, having seen the doctor write the other one, was looked upon as the most competent to undertake this literary effort, and to him the task was unanimously delegated. This question having been settled, the more practical one of what to write with and what to write upon claimed attention, and here was a difficulty which very nearly relieved Joe of his onerous duty, since neither pen, pencil, nor paper had been brought from Johnson's. After much deliberation, and while various suggestions of a highly impracticable nature were being showered upon him, Joe suddenly sprang from his recumbent position beneath a large fir and exclaimed, "You fellas just hold your clack a minute, I'll fix this thing in no time," and began hastily to descend the side of the hill to the stream below.
"Go it while you're young," shouted one of them, and the others laughed as the momentum which Joe acquired in his descent began to render his movements rather more rapid than graceful.
The laugh deepened into a roar, interspersed with catcalls and shrill whistles, as Joe lost his footing entirely and rolled like a log to the bottom, only saving himself from plunging into the creek by securing a firm grasp upon a bunch of willows growing on the bank. Spending but a moment to take an inventory of his scratches and bruises, Joe began walking along the bank, peering intently into the water, his movements closely watched by his companions above, who were full of curiosity as to the meaning of his actions. He soon stepped down to the margin of the water and was for 2 minutes lost to sight. Then he reappeared, bearing in his arms a large, flat stone worn smooth by the action of the water. After considerable puffing and blowing, he climbed the hill and, throwing the stone upon the ground, sat down to rest.
"What are you going to do with that there?"
asked Bud Jackson, while one of the others took occasion to remark that a man was
a danged fool what had rolled down a hill after a stone when the mountain was full of 'em.
"Never you mind," said Joe, with a look of wisdom and confidence in his countenance. "You fellas just hold your wind, and I'll show you a little engine business I learned when I was a kid up on the Wabash."
Joe quickly gathered an armful of sticks and kindled a fire.
He then stood the stone up on its edge, the smooth side turned toward the blaze, and propped it up with a few stones and a short stick. He then sat down again, filled his pipe, lighted it, and reclining on his elbow began to smoke in the most unconcerned and contented manner.
"What's all this funny business?"
asked one, whose curiosity and impatience began to get the better of him.
"That's all right. Just you wait a few minutes and you'll know all about it."
Thus admonished, the remainder of the committee followed their scribe's example, and soon each several individual was industriously engaged in sending upward frequent puffs of smoke to mingle with the darker variety from the fire and contaminating the purer atmosphere of the mountains. In about 10 minutes, the stone became sufficiently dry to suit the scribe, and he arose from the ground, put his pipe in his pocket, drew out his knife, and sharpened the end of a stick that he had previously selected. This he thrust into the fire and left it there until it had become charred.
"I ain't as much of an artist as I used to was,"
said he, as he took the stone and propped it up against a log at a convenient angle for writing.
"And I never was quite equal to them old master fellers, but I reckon I can sort of put something on this here stone as that there feller will understand the meaning of."
With this remark, and with the committee standing at his back on either side, Joe, after much effort and several recharrings of his stick, succeeded in producing the following brief but intelligible illustrated inscription upon the stone. I'm going to have to describe the inscription to you because obviously I can't show it to you in a podcast. It's a crudely drawn skull and crossbones, underneath of which are the words in all capital letters, "You get right sudden," and signed "Committee." This met with strong expressions of approbation from the entire committee, and fastening the inscribed stone securely between two of the other boulders which crowned the heap of brush once constituting the hut, they departed in high spirits for Johnson's, where they related the details of their expedition to a large and interested gathering, the narrative being frequently interspersed with libations. Thus, for several weeks, the matter rested. No more smoke was seen to rise from the site of the demolished hut by travelers along the base of the hill, and that the mysterious stranger had heeded the warning of the committee and taken his departure, no one doubted. One day, there came down the trail from that direction a man leading a pack mule, upon which was loaded the usual miner's outfit. He stopped at Johnson's and purchased a number of articles, offering in payment a small lump of gold, such as was common in the diggings. Johnson recognized him instantly as the man who had, about 2 months before, interrupted the Saturday night convivialities to request the loan of a blanket. It was not infrequent for a miner to be broke 1 month and have plenty of dust another, and so Johnson's suspicions were not aroused. But he had a curiosity to know where the man had struck it rich, and remarked, "You seem to have hit it about right, stranger." "Yes, I've had very good success," replied the man in a dignified and refined tone.
"Whereabouts, may I ask?"
"Oh, up the creek a short distance," said the man, and he nodded to the proprietor of Betsyville and resumed his journey down the trail. A few days later after this, Wabash Joe felt a prompting to visit the site of the demolished hut. It must be confessed that this impulse was not a supernatural one, but the extremely natural desire possessed by every new candidate for literary honors. He was anxious to learn what effect his literary effort had produced, and what kind of treatment it had met at the hands of the stranger to whom it was addressed. Accordingly, he took no companion with him on his first visit. Upon arriving at the scene of his artistic labors, he went at once to the pile of brush upon which his tablet had been deposited. There it was, but it had been laid down flat upon the brush between two boulders. Lying thereon was a piece of paper held down by a weight, and when his eyes rested upon it, they swelled to wonderful proportions. He seized it and eagerly turned it over and over in his hand. It was a piece of rotten quartz as large as a walnut, and threads of free gold were protruding from it on every side. He estimated its value at fully $100. He opened the letter and read, with deepened interest and astonishment, the following letter. "To the extremely curious and gentlemanly citizens of Betsyville, at Johnson's assembled, greeting. Not in compliance with your extremely kind and urgent invitation, but because I have made enough in the past few weeks to last me the balance of my days, do I take my departure and leave you this farewell message. To you, jointly and severally, I present my ledge of decomposed quartz, which has made me rich, and which will make all of you equally rich, if you find it. In witness thereof, I have hereunto affixed this specimen of its contents, and my name, on this, the 3rd day of September in the year of grace, 1854. James Watson."
As soon as he fully comprehended the import of the letter, Joe hastened with all speed back to Johnson's, where he duly exhibited it and the specimen to the eager Betsyites. The excitement created was the greatest known in camp, and was intensified when Johnson related his interview with the stranger, and it was discovered that the date of his appearance and departure toward Wairika corresponded with the date of the letter, or deed of gift. For the next few weeks, the mountain in the vicinity of the demolished hut echoed to the tread and shouts of eager Betsyites, but their most diligent search met with no reward. No trace of the ledge of decomposed quartz could be found, and not the least sign of mining operations other than those well known before were to be seen within a radius of several miles. Inquiry at Wairika by one of the agents of Johnson who visited that great mining center developed the fact that about a week after the date of the stranger's departure, a man entered that city with a pack mule, which he sold at auction in the street. He then purchased a Wells Fargo & Company draft on San Francisco for $70,000 and took his departure in the stage. The gold paid for the draft was coarse. A portion of it was mixed with quartz, showing conclusively the character of the diggings from which it had come. This, combined with the fact that no robbery was reported, and that no claim in the vicinity of Betsyville produced such specimens as the stranger had left as a witness to his deed of gift, was conclusive evidence to the minds of many that the ledge of decomposed quartz had an existence in reality, and that patient search would surely reveal its locality. The most enthusiastic and persistent prospector was Wabash Joe, who retained possession of the specimen nugget as the perquisite of his literary genius, and who devoted his entire time to the work of discovery until at last, having exhausted all his means, lost his claim, and even been compelled to sell his talismanic specimen to procure the necessary grub upon which to live while prosecuting his search, he abandoned the camp in disgust, and was seen among the convivial crowd at Johnson's no more. From that day to this, not a year has passed that someone has not made an effort to discover the Hermit's Ledge, as it is known by old-timers. Yet under the new order of affairs, and under the excitements of more recent events, the story of the Hermit of the Siskiyous and his ledge of gold finds but few to relate it, and fewer still to give it credence. Well, that's the end of the reading for today. If you're listening to this for the first time, this is a Thursday special. It's not like our usual Offbeat Oregon history readings. But full details of Offbeat Oregon history can be found at our website, which is offbeatoregon.com. If you want to read a text version of this article or of some of the other recent Thursday specials, click on the link in the header that's marked Lies of Oregon. Once again, you've been listening to a short story by Henry Lawrence, published in the January 1887 edition of the West Shore magazine, published out of Portland, Oregon. Since it is a variant on the ubiquitous Lost Cabin gold mine story, I wouldn't be too surprised to find if it had been adopted into popular legend. Our theme music is a track by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. And if you're coming to Corvallis, you should definitely drop me a line so we can grab a cup of coffee and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. The recording of this podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. But of course, being as it was published in 1887, the article itself is in the public domain. That's it for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about Giles Lake, which was at one time a marshy lake, directly underneath of what is now some of the most valuable real estate property in northwest Portland, along the river there. It was a bit of a water wonderland once, and it was the scene for the 1905 World's Fair, within 20 years of which Giles Lake had been filled up and houses and buildings and factories built on top of it. It no longer exists. I'll have that full story for you after about 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. In the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.